Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sitting in front of me is the wonderful John Sheehan, known throughout the world for his long career with the Dubliners and for the sublime sounds he creates with his fiddle. And I'm also delighted that John is here with us this morning, along with his good friend and honorary Dubliner, Michael Howard, who played with the group for many years. He and John released an album together a few years ago, and Michael has also worked with other greats and goods of the music world. John and Michael, thanks so much for being here in our studio this morning. It's ahead of course, Tradfest in Temple Bar next week, which is sold out. Yeah, so it's a great honour you're here. Listen, just take it away. Before you played that fiddle of yours, John, tell me how precious that fiddle is to you.
It's like my wife. Mary calls it my second wife or my first wife sometimes. I have it about 50 years and a fiddle is one of those personal instruments. You know, you get to know each other's little faults and failings and accommodate each other, and that's the way it works, you know.
And we'll talk about it later on, but just as we were coming into studio, you told me and you wanted me to say it, that you're going to be 80 this year. You look about 20 years younger. What are you
thank
on?
You. I only look about 79.
No, you look amazing.
Yeah, I'm
healthy.
80 in May. I'm 80 in May, Miriam. Yeah, I feel great, thanks be to God. The health is great and been very lucky that way, you know.
Because you are the only survivor of the Dubliners, aren't you?
The last man standing, as they used to say, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, we're going to talk much later on in the show, but for now, you're going to play for us this morning the beautiful Among Friends.
Yeah, one of my own little pieces. Okay, Michael.
John and Michael, thanks so much. Your composition, Among Friends, you're going to come back later on. And of course, it's all ahead of Tradfest, which is happening next Wednesday, the 23rd. Well, my next guests this morning are a married couple. Patricia Casey is the well-known professor of psychiatry at the Mater Hospital here in Dublin. And her husband, John McGuigan, is both a barrister and a blogger. Patricia is also patron of the Iona Institute and a columnist with the Irish Independent. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in. Listen, you're here largely, I suppose, to talk about the loss, almost exactly exactly 1 year ago of your precious 24-year-old student son Gavin to cancer. It's still very raw, I know, but you both want to be here this morning to talk about him, to reflect on your own experience of trying to deal with such a catastrophic tragedy. And I suppose how one day we all have to try and learn to deal with grief and bereavement. But listen, first though, I want to go back a bit to your lives even before you both met. Where did you grow up, Patricia?
I grew up in a place called Ballinoe in County Cork, and I still go back there. I've got very strong ties to the place. I didn't always want to be a doctor, but I remember when I was doing what we used to call domestic science at school, and we had to do a bit of anatomy and physiology and medical stuff. And I thought, this is very interesting. And I decided, yeah, I'll give medicine a whirl. And I said to my mother, look, I think I'd like to be a doctor, Mum. And of course, she was delighted. And the rest is history. I did medicine at UCC. When I wanted to do psychiatry, though, she wasn't a bit happy about it. She wanted me to be a dermatologist or a GP or something. And she didn't want me to be a psychiatrist, but I did. And here I am.
Why did you want to be a psychiatrist? I would have imagined that's could be a very difficult discipline in medicine.
It's a stupid answer, but I don't know why I wanted to be a psychiatrist. During our attachments in medicine, when you go out to the hospitals and do attachments in different specialties, and the first day I did psychiatry, I thought, wow, this is for me. I felt really comfortable. I felt at home with the patients. I felt I was able to talk to them. And I also thought psychiatrists were very nice people. They were much nicer than surgeons or than pathologists or anybody in those days. So a variety of very superficial things drew me to psychiatry.
John, your husband, tell me about your background. Where did you grow up, John?
Well, I'm an Englishman, as you can probably tell.
That's okay.
My father was a soldier, so I was brought up in many different parts of the world because we were travelling around a lot. And then we eventually settled in Nottingham, and I think of myself as being from Nottingham, although I was actually born in York. But Nottingham was where we settled, and Nottingham was where I spent most of my time in England, yes.
And was there ever any pressure on you to go into the military services?
Well, there was. My father was a soldier, my grandfather was a soldier, and all my brothers, I have four brothers, they were all soldiers too. So
wow.
I left school at 15. I had no real educational achievements at all. And it was either manual work or shop work.
And you, of course, became a soldier yourself.
I did, yes. I was a soldier for a number of years. I was an army photographer. In fact, spent some very happy years in the military as a photographer, yeah.
So, Patricia, where did you both meet? Where did you meet this Englishman?
We met when I was training to be a psychiatrist in Nottingham.
She was crossing one of my picket lines. I was a trade union organiser at the time, and we were organising a picket at the hospital where Patricia worked, the mental hospital, Mapley Hospital. We weren't supposed to stop the doctors crossing the picket line, but the local branch secretary did stop everybody crossing the picket line, and I was sent by the general secretary to sort him out. Patricia was at the front of the queue there.
Do you remember that moment?
I do, very well.
Tell me about it.
Well, he said, I'll arrange for you to cross the picket line provided you come and have a pint with me.
Yep, that was it. Yeah, I cleared up the mess with the local branch secretary and let everybody through on condition that the first person in the car, who was a very beautiful young doctor, would come and have a pint with me.
Not there and then, a few days later.
A few days later.
And then obviously you came home to Ireland and made your home here.
Yes, I moved to Edinburgh and we commuted between Nottingham and Edinburgh because I was doing research in Edinburgh. I was doing some research into suicide and suicide prevention at the unit there. And then I got a position as senior lecturer in Cork and we commuted between Cork and Nottingham. And then I got the chair in UCD in 1992. And by then John had moved to Ireland and was studying law and had become a barrister.
And when you were working as a psychiatrist, even as a young doctor and throughout your career, has it changed a lot, Patricia, in terms of, do you think there's too much overdiagnosis now or not?
It's changed hugely. The array of medications available has improved considerably, increased and improved. The array of psychological therapies have increased and improved. Some of the physical treatments like ECT are now very seldom used. The old psychiatric institutions have closed and we now have units in general hospitals. So there's been a huge change, I would say, for the better, very much, very definitely for the better. there is, in my opinion, a tendency to overdiagnose depression in particular, depressive illness, and to prescribe antidepressants. I think some people who are very unhappy, who have terrible things happen to them, become sad and gloomy, and they are very frequently prescribed medications, and I don't think that is a good idea. Firstly, they don't work in those circumstances. Antidepressants are not a treatment for unhappiness. Sadly, unhappiness is something one has to go through and try and solve and address in, you know, using one's own resilience and supports rather than medication. So medication doesn't work, but it also creates a sense in people that they're vulnerable and that they need these props. And I don't think that is a good thing for society and for the individuals in it to feel they need to have props all the time, that they need either medication or indeed psychological therapy, when really what they're going through are understandable and appropriate reactions to terrible situations.
And obviously, medication for certain serious conditions, you believe in, but it's just when people are being overdiagnosed and aren't actually depressed.
Yes, I prescribe antidepressants all the time. I stop them very commonly as well in people whom I think have been given them inappropriately. But I think we're the problem with psychiatry is we don't have any biological markers to help us make accurate diagnoses in the way that, say, you have in medicine. So that's a problem. It's based on what the person says and what they tell you and how they present to you. So it's a bit more nebulous. Making diagnosis is a bit more nebulous and therefore a bit more challenging. It's more of an art than a science, really. But yes, I don't want listeners to go away thinking that they shouldn't be taking prescribed medications. If there's a doubt about their diagnosis, they should discuss it with their doctors.
So, John, you then went on to have a family. Tell me about your two boys.
Well, the two boys, James and Gavin, are both adopted. We adopted them both while we were living in Cork. They were babies when they were adopted, and we met their birth parents, both for James and for Gavin. And I can't remember what year that was. It must have been 1990 or 92 or something like that. And we just had a wonderful time with the boys, you know. And it was a very close family, still is a very close family, what's left of us. And what can you say? I mean, it was just an ordinary family life and a very successful family life.
And we had a very good relationship with the boys' biological parents as well. We meet them, they contact us.
I think that part of the story is particularly super because we always kept in touch with the birth parents. And when the boys became 18, they met their birth parents. And
They were 18, actually.
Before they were 18, yes. Mm-hmm. And they meet them on a regular basis, or met them on a regular basis. They would go and spend holidays with them, and they would come round for meals with us. And it was a wonderful relationship. It became a much bigger family.
Why did you adopt? Did you try to have children yourself, Patricia?
Yes, I mean, I wasn't becoming pregnant and I didn't want to pursue IVF. And I think I probably would have to try that now before I could adopt. But in those days, one didn't have to. And so we went and applied to adopt. And the application process and the assessment process is actually very difficult and very intrusive.
Well, it was very intrusive. They thought I was too old. And I don't think they were too pleased that I was English.
And divorced.
Yes, with children from a previous marriage. And it was a very, very intrusive process indeed. We fought hard for those two boys, and it was worth it.
So tell me about the first time. The eldest boy is James, is that correct?
Yes, James, yes.
Can you remember the moment of the day when you heard you were going to get James, that James was going to become your son?
Yes, I remember the social worker ringing us and saying that the panel, it had to go before a panel. She came out and visited us many times and she tried to make the process as easy as possible, but that was impossible given the issue at stake. But she rang and said, I'm pleased to say that it's been agreed by the panel that you can adopt, and I've got a little boy in mind for you. But I have to discuss it with his birth mother because she wants a certain type of parent, and I hope you'll fit the bill for her. I think you will. but we'll have to see. And sure enough, we did fit the bill, and we met her before we adopted.
The birth
James,
mother.
The birth mother. We met her before we adopted James. And we have been in touch all the time. There was a year, period of a year when we lost contact through neither of our faults, actually. It was a misunderstanding about whether she could actually be in touch with us or not. But we resumed it very quickly, and we've been in touch. And she is working. She lives abroad now and has her own family. And James visits regularly. He was over there just a few months ago.
Well, she's a very beautiful girl, Fiona. And she has two beautiful daughters, and we had lunch with them in London just over the Christmas period. It's a good feeling.
And can you remember the first moment you both saw James? I was in that moment when you introduced your new son.
I remember us. He was. We went to Cork to meet him.
He had a lot of hair.
He had a lot of hair and still has.
Great.
He was 3 months old, and we met him and we took him out to the Silver Springs Hotel so as to have time with him on our own and for me to get, just for us to get used to the little fella. And I remember he was very active. He was crawling everywhere, even at 3 months. He was really active, crawling all over the place. He walked at 8 months.
Wow.
And I remember him there in the Silver Springs. And then when it came to adopting Gavin, we replicated going to the Silver Springs. We'd brought Gavin to the Silver Springs. So yes, I remember the Silver Springs and James.
And how much younger than James was Gavin?
About 3.5 years.
3.5 years. And was it easier the second time to adopt? Because I suppose you'd proved yourselves as good parents,
It wasn't quite so intrusive the second time round.
And tell me about the first time you met Gavin. I know you brought him to Silver Springs. Did he have lots of hair?
No, he had blonde hair, very fine blonde hair. He had hair. I mean, he wasn't bald like some babies are.
Yeah.
He was three months old as well. And he had blonde hair. And I remember he smiled at me.
And we met his birth mother and father together.
Yes.
I can't remember where it was.
At the handover, they actually handed him over to us physically. And James was with us. And James went up and kissed Gavin. And we took a photograph of it, but the photograph didn't come out, unfortunately. So we haven't managed to capture that moment in a photograph.
And did they get on well as little boys and as brothers, John?
Oh, yes, they were very, very close. Until the very end, they were very, very close. And I don't think we could have managed the passing of Gavin without James's help. Yeah.
James had just finished his PhD in the UK. He was doing a PhD in philosophy, and he had just finished it. And he came home to help. This was in the August 2017, because Gavin was becoming increasingly frail and needing more and more assistance. And James said he would come home, and he did. And without James, it would have been extraordinarily difficult. Having James around meant that Gavin didn't have to go into a hospice. I would never have wanted James to go, Gavin to go to a hospice.
They had an extraordinary relationship. They were very, very close.
Very close. And right up to the end, they were great mates. They would text each other and email each other, and they'd meet on Facebook. And James was just wonderful with him. And Gavin was very fond of James.
Plus, Gavin was a little, what's the word, pissed off. I don't know whether you keep that in the text.
That's fine.
Because James is a vegan and and has rather some politically correct views, and Gavin didn't. But apart from that, they were just wonderful friends, you know.
Go back to when Gavin first got ill, either of you. Do you want to start, John? When did you first hear that Gavin might be ill?
We were at the Edinburgh Festival. We go to the Edinburgh Festival every year, and he developed a limp, and we didn't think too much about it. We thought he'd injured himself moshing, because he was a bit of a goth and he used to go to gigs and do a lot of moshing and so on, and didn't think too much about it. But the pain persisted, and we sent him home to Dublin, and phone call came back to say it was a tumour.
I remember it.
In the spine.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of two terrible years.
Mm. August the 21st.
2017.
2017 at 10 to 2. I was in a shop in Edinburgh called MacBool's. I was having a dinner party that night because lots of friends join us in Edinburgh and we were having a dinner. I was in MacBool's shopping. And I contacted a colleague in the matter in the ED, in the emergency department, to do a scan to see, because I thought it was a slip disc. And he rang me at 10 to 2 in MacBool's. I was standing at the meat counter. And he said, Gavin has a tumour, a spinal tumour. And that was it. And I sat outside the shop and I must have looked very pale because I'd always remember this, a young man walking along with a bottle of water and a burger in his hand said, are you all right? And I said, no, I'm not. I've just heard my son has cancer. And he said, I'll call a cab for you. And he did. And then he said to me, God bless you, I'll pray for you. And he walked away. I always remember that.
So kind of him.
It was very kind. It was very kind. Very kind.
How old was Gavin in 2017, John, when he was first diagnosed?
I get confused about this. I think he was 23.
24. 22 what? Days after his 24th birthday.
Yeah.
Now, you're a doctor, you're a professor of psychiatry. Patricia, you obviously, were you able to draw on all the experience you have to try and hold it together? And did you think lots of people survive cancer, don't they? They yes. get cancer and they go on to survive it. So I assume that was your attitude.
That was my attitude. But also I was able to just read up on the literature on spinal cancers and see that they have poor, very poor prognosis. I saw some studies that suggested maybe there was a bit of an improvement with certain treatments, but on the whole, I knew from the beginning the outlook wasn't great, but I was hoping against hope. Gavin had had a different cancer when he was 5. He had had a cancer of the nose, which he survived. And that had a poor prognosis as well, but he had survived it. And I thought, well, he survived one bad cancer, perhaps he will this one. But unfortunately, he didn't respond to the standard treatment.
At one stage, I thought he'd lose his legs, and you know, that was tragic and horrible. But he would survive.
Mm.
And, they couldn't do that. They couldn't remove his legs without.
Mm.
And they couldn't do it.
How cruel that he had cancer as a little boy, survived it and it came back.
Yes. Well, it was a different cancer the second time round. Apparently, 8% of people get second cancers, completely separate cancers, and 1% get 3 cancers. I hadn't known that. I'd assumed that if you had one cancer that you had suffered enough, and I wasn't aware of that, although I have one or two patients who have had since then who have had two completely separate cancers, not secondary spread, but actually independent cancers. But I wasn't aware of it until it befell poor Gavin.
So how, as a doctor and as a mother and as a father, do you deal with that when your son is so young, just 24? Do you tell him as you go through that the prognosis is bleak, or do you keep him positive all the time? I often wonder that. You just try and stay positive.
Well, we did tell him the prognosis. He never asked us if he was going to die.
Mm.
And he never, for one minute, thought he was going to die until... He never did. He always thought he'd recover and he'd go back to college and he'd see his friends. But he knew the prognosis was bad. And he was on experimental drugs and he knew he was fading. He knew he was getting ill. He's lost the use of his legs and he was in a wheelchair and he couldn't... We were lifting him into and out of bed and into and out of the car. He knew he was in a serious state, but he still was very positive and thought that he would be in a year or two back at college with his friends and going to gigs again. And
the fact that he was on experimental drugs sustained him. I mean, the only time he ever asked me was quite early on. He said, Mum, is there a possibility that this could kill me? And I said, there is, Gavin. That's always the way with cancer. but you survived before and hopefully you will with this, and you're getting the best treatments. And then when the treatments didn't work, we went on to get new treatments, and that was facilitated by two wonderful oncologists, John McCaffrey in the Mater, who dealt with Gavin very briefly, and he was willing to give him experimental drugs, because it's quite difficult to get experimental drugs in Ireland. We would have had to pay for them, and we were going to do that, and he was willing to do it. But then Professor John Crown contacted me. He'd heard about Gavin, and he had a drug trial of an experimental drug. And he said he would take him into the drug trial, and we tried that. And when that didn't work, then there was another option that we went for, and that was tried. And that drug was only stopped about just 10 days before he passed away. So all the time, Gavin was given hope, and I feel very strongly that that should be the case. People were telling us you should tell Gavin that you sit down and have the conversation with him. And I knew my son, and John knew his son, and we decided that we couldn't do that, and that Gavin really wouldn't cope with that, that it would be cruel to take all hope from him. So we didn't do that, but we vowed that we would answer his, if he asked us directly, am I going to die from this, that we would answer him as sensitively as we could, but as honestly, but he didn't ask us that. And that was the kind of person Gavin was. He was able to compartmentalise things. And he was always positive, even when he was at school and doing no study. I remember during his leaving cert, I'd look out the window, you know, the week of his leaving cert, and Gavin loved climbing trees. He'd be up a tree when he should be studying for his exam the following morning. And he would say, oh, I'll be all right. And that was, he had that great facility, and that really sustained him, because he remained very resilient throughout his cancer. And I think it was that capacity to put things into a little box and put them aside and forget about them until you really had to. So he never, I mean, there would be sometimes as he was getting frailer, he would become upset and distressed, but it would very quickly pass again and he'd get back to being online. And his friends who came to the funeral, and I asked them, and his father, his biological father, and whom he was in regular contact, because he was into computering as well, I've asked all of them, did Gavin ever give any inkling that he thought he was going to die? And they said no. To all of them, he had the belief that he was going to get well and get back to college again. And I'm very happy how we handled that. And to any parents facing this, I think they should think carefully before being brutally honest with their children. And I remember around the time that Gavin was dying effectively, there was a crowdfunding for a boy of 18 or 19 in England who had a similar cancer. And his parents didn't have any money, and they were going to be taking him to Germany for one of these new treatments, and they had to crowdfund 200,000. And there was a picture of him on whichever English Sunday paper it was. And the look of terror in that boy's face absolutely convinced me that we did the right thing. This boy was saying, I'm going to die if I can't get this treatment. And he was terrified looking. He had this haunted look on his face, and it convinced me even more that John and I had made the right decision.
You kept him with hope.
With hope, yeah.
Yeah.
And his birth parents, who all came to see him on a regular basis while he was ill, they were very positive too. We owe them such a lot, those birth parents. His birth father helped me carry the coffin to the grave. They were pretty good.
And his birth mother,
the best of the Irish.
His birth mother walked with me down the aisle behind the coffin. And they were there beside us at the grave.
That's so wonderful and extraordinary that you were all involved. Because you all loved Gavin.
Yes. Yes.
Well, he was a great guy.
Did it test your faith, Patricia, when something like this happens? In other words, he's only 24. He's a beautiful young man with his whole life ahead of him. Mm-hmm. Do you have to almost divorce the doctor, Patricia, from the mother, Patricia, to try and rationalise what happened?
Yes, I mean, I was very seldom the doctor, Patricia. I was the mam, the mum. It surprisingly, it didn't test my faith. When Gavin was ill the first time round, it tested it much more. I can't explain it because I had anticipated that it would. I know that when Gavin was dying, he was in St. Vincent's, and a priest friend, the priest who married us, he was there. He was at the naming ceremonies for the boys when we adopted them. When Gavin got ill, he's been a very dear friend, Father Casey, Gerard Casey, in Cork. He's in Donnerail in Cork. And he said, I want to come up to see Gavin. And I said, fine, but I'm not sure about the last sacraments or not. Mm-hmm. I said, because Gavin is an agnostic. He wasn't an atheist, he was an agnostic. But Gavin was unconscious in bed. And I thought, well, I don't know if heaven exists or not. I don't know. But we've done the best we can for Gavin with medicines. Maybe, and the decision was mine, because John, you know, isn't a believer. But I said, I want to do the best I can for Gavin spiritually, so maybe we will. I will let Gavin have the last sacraments. Gavin himself wouldn't have minded. He'd have said, whatever, I don't care. So I thought, let's do it. So Father Casey did. And as he put the oils on his forehead, he said to me, you know, Jesus touched Gavin now. He'll be with Jesus very shortly. And that actually was amazingly helpful to me personally. If there is a God in a heaven, I'm sure it was helpful to Gavin. But to me, spiritually, that was immensely helpful. And we have a friend in Edinburgh, an artist whom we meet every year at the festival. They come and stay with us, Rob Hain. And he's of a different faith tradition completely. And I was telling him about this. And he said to me last year when we were there, we were up late one night chatting. John had gone to bed. And we were chatting, and he was saying, yeah, he said, Father Casey is right. There is an afterlife, and Jesus would have touched him. And this is a man from a completely different faith tradition. Mm. And all of that has kind of sustained my personal faith. I don't know where it'll go in the future.
Do you think you'll see him in heaven someday?
I talk to him every day.
Do you?
Yes.
Where, at different times, or?
Usually first thing in the morning. And in the evening, at the end of my day, I update him on what I've done for the day. I ask his help in guiding me with things I'm doing, particularly difficult patients. Difficult, not in the sense that they're difficult or unpleasant, but in the sense that they're complex management problems. I ask him to guide me about that. I ask him just the little things as well.
Yep. Yeah, and Patricia visits the grave fairly regularly. I don't. I find it difficult to visit the grave. And I see him. I see him all the time. I see him on the bus, sitting at his computer. And I just see him. But we grieve in different ways.
You wrote a beautiful blog, actually, John, which I downloaded this morning. It's on your own blog. I mean, you work as a barrister, John, but your blog is Broadsides, a collection of bits and pieces. And it's titled, With His Long Hair and Gentle Ways. It's really beautiful. And it's for anyone who's perhaps dealing with grief, particularly men, because I think, I mean, I'm not the doctor or psychiatrist here, but do men and women, do you think, deal with grief differently, Patricia, or not?
I think they do. I think men's grief is more silent, like John's. Women's grief is much more externalised. We're able to talk about it. We're able to openly cry. they're different. I don't think there's anything wrong with men's grief. This idea that men should grieve in the same way, or behave emotionally in the same way that women do is nonsense, I think. But we do grieve differently, I think.
I don't think it's a macho thing or a male-female thing. I find it very difficult to visit the grave or to listen to cancer stories. And here I am talking about a cancer story. I can't listen to these on the radio. I turn the radio down. Hmm. And I can't watch them on the TV. Change the channel. But I like to sit in churches. I have no faith, but I find churches are a very comforting place to sit and think about, Gavin.
Mm. And you also think, Peter, that it's very important that people allow themselves cry.
Yes. I'm very concerned at the numbers of people, and I've had to deal with it myself, telling me, oh, you need help, you need to go for counselling, without asking how you're grieving. Grief is perfectly normal. As long as you have somebody that you can confide in. Now, if you're alone in the world and can't, you know, don't have anybody to talk to or to any shoulder to cry on or any confidant, it's different. And maybe that's when you do need professional, you do need to see somebody. But it doesn't need to be a therapist, it can be a friend, a spouse, a neighbour, a partner, a son, a daughter. That's what you need. They're the people you need to turn to. It's fine to cry. There's absolutely nothing wrong with crying. There's nothing wrong with turning off the television when there's a cancer story. Like John, I can't listen or watch cancer stories. And I press the off button when I hear them. And that's normal. Mm-hmm. So I get very upset and I get extremely annoyed when people tell me that I need, and it was happening when Gavin was ill as well, people telling me that I need to see somebody. And I know it's well-meaning. I don't think people are not doing it through malice. They're doing it because they want to make things better. But there are some things that can't be made better and can only be made better with time. Mm. And that's what we have to go through, John and I, and other people in this position. We have to let time do the healing.
It must help that you're such a close couple. Like, I'm sitting in front of you and I can see what a close couple you are, because some people say that terrible tragedy like you have suffered can tear you apart or bring you closer.
Yes, that does happen, unfortunately.
Of course, we never argue, do we, Patricia?
Of course we don't.
How is your other son, James, surviving without his best buddy, I suppose, as you said they were so close?
Well, of course, James has his grieving to do as well, and I'm sure he misses Gavin as much as we do, if not more. He was very, very close to him. I don't know.
Mm. James has been absolutely super. He's been wonderful.
Yeah. We certainly couldn't have made it through the year without James's assistance and support. Yeah. And we owe him quite a lot, but he just takes it in his stride. You know,
yes, he does. And he talks about Gavin very openly, which is good. Some young men don't. I've heard of you know, other young men who have lost siblings who can't talk about them. But James talks about Gavin, and he talks to me about him. Mm. And he dreams about him. He had a funny dream shortly after he died that Gavin was heavily into computers, and he dreamt that Gavin was in heaven and he was hacking into the into the heavenly computer system, and he texted James and told him not to tell God. So James was very amused at that dream, and so was I. But James is getting on with life. He got his PhD in philosophy in aesthetics, and he's writing on that, and he's doing arty things in, that involve aesthetics. He's gone back to music. He wants to become a music teacher. So he's getting on with life. And he came with us to the festival and we did the usual things at the festival. So he's, I think, he's young and he's resilient and he's got lots of friends.
Do you find, though, because often I think in society when you go out, now not everyone has children, but often when if you meet a stranger and you get to know them, if you're at a party, they often say, have you got children? So you constantly perhaps have to tell the narrative, oh yes, I have two, but one died recently. Do you find that difficult or not?
That's terribly difficult. I mentioned in the blog that I happened to be in the doctor's surgery just last week. And the receptionist who knows the family said, oh, look, we've treated Gavin here. How's Gavin? And because that's terribly difficult. I mean, I broke up. I mean, Gavin didn't make it. I had to tell her Gavin didn't make it. And she was very upset and we were both crying.
Yes, I've had that experience as well. When I say that, you know, Gavin sadly passed away and then I cry and some people cry with me and some people just kind of, you can see they're uncomfortable with it and move topic, and that's fine too. Interestingly, here in Ireland, people are asking all the time, how's Gavin? And people who know he's passed away will ask us how we're getting on. But I spend a lot of time in England, and the people there, people that I care about and know very well, don't ask me. And I think the English are terribly uncomfortable with death. They're not comfortable talking about it at all. Their funerals are very different to ours.
Yeah.
So it's a whole different ball game when I'm in England. People just don't ask. And if I venture to mention, you know, Gavin, in some way, they get even more uncomfortable than Irish people do who don't know that Gavin has died when we tell them. So they have a very different way of dealing with death. And I think our way is much more helpful and normal than the British way.
Do you find it comforting sometimes for someone who's close to you here to talk to you about him? Do you like to talk about Gavin?
It depends. Sometimes it's very easy, but when I get upset, it's very painful. The funny bits about Gavin are nice. I like those. But talking about his illness is brutally painful.
Well, we talk to each other about Gavin. I mean,
yeah.
What he would like to eat if we were out at a restaurant,
yes.
What he would be likely to order off the menu, or if one of his favourite comedians is on the box, you know, Bill Bailey or Lee Mack or whatever. We talk about him and we share little confidences about him and to ourselves, but I don't speak to him to third parties at all.
Your job, I think, is a really difficult one, Patricia. I mean, you're a psychiatrist. Do you find it difficult to do your job when you have to deal with such an emotionally difficult, probably the most difficult anyone could experience, the death of your son? I mean, how do you do that? Was there a moment where you thought, I can't continue to be a psychiatrist and listen to other people's problems? Because frankly, I have the biggest problem going on in my life right now.
When poor Gavin was ill and I knew he was going to pass away, I did wonder, would I be able to continue working? I went back to work very quickly. I went back to work within a week. I don't have any difficulty doing that. I'm able to compartmentalise it. I think it's probably Gavin helping me along the way. It hasn't been difficult. Now, if somebody came in with a problem and mentioned that they had lost a son of Gavin's age, I would probably crumble. I remember that happened once when Gavin was five, when he was ill, when he was as a young boy, little boy. And after he recovered, a patient came in one day who had lost a son and I started crying. I was lucky my son was alive. This poor patient had lost her son and I had to refer the person to a colleague because I couldn't deal with it. I suspect if that happened now, the same would happen. It hasn't happened. I'm able to deal with the people who come to see me, and that's fine. But I think probably Gavin is helping me through.
And also, is work in a way sometimes a distraction?
Yes. It is. And my work, thankfully, is very varied, as well as seeing patients. I'm involved in editing a journal and I'm writing books and doing research. And I'm doing various different things professionally, and they're a distraction and they're tapping into different bits of me, none of which tap into the grief I feel for Gavin. And that's good.
He would want you, though, as we come to the end of this interview, to be happy in your lives, wouldn't he? He wouldn't want your lives, for the rest of your lives, to be destroyed by his leaving this world. That, does that keep you going as well?
Well, it does. I mean, towards the end, we go to Edinburgh Festival every year. We weren't going to the Edinburgh Festival in 17 and 18. And he was very upset, saying, "You must go to the festival. Don't worry about me. You know, I'll manage myself in this hydraulic bed with this hydraulic lift in this wheelchair, and I'll manage myself. You must go to the festival because you enjoy the festival so much." And he would want us to do that. In fact, we went to the festival last year precisely because he had encouraged us to go there. It was a difficult festival. It wasn't an enjoyable festival. It wasn't a joy and a laugh like it was every year, but he had wanted us to do it. And it was part of our tribute to him that we did.
Final question. There'll be lots of people listening this morning, Patricia and John, who have lost someone they adore as well. What have you learned through your horrific experience of what's the best way to deal with the loss of a son or a daughter or a husband or a wife or a best friend? What is the best way to deal with that? As you say, it's part of life.
Mm-hmm. Cry when you feel like it. Be happy when you feel like it. Have somebody that you can cry with or talk to about it. Doesn't need to be a professional person. A friend, a neighbour, a child. But don't assume that because you're crying, you're abnormal. Crying is fine.
I don't know what advice I would give. I don't know that I would have taken much advice before it happened. It happens. I say shit happens. That was the worst thing that probably happened, and you deal with it. You take it and you deal with it and you pass through it. There's nothing you can do about it. There's not all the money in the world, not all the doctors, all the nurses. There's nothing that can be done, and you just depend on your love for your child and get through it.
Well, John McGuigan and Patricia Casey, it's been my privilege to talk to you both today and to see the enormous love you have for your son Gavin and your son James. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I've had an avalanche of texts about Patricia Casey and John McGuigan, their husband, about their son. I actually don't have time to read them all, but they're all beautiful. I'll just give you one. It's the love of these parents for their son Gavin is so beautiful and alive. They keep their son's memory alive by sharing their raw grief. Thank you, Patricia and John. I probably have hundreds of them. I can't read them out, but I will send them on to Patricia and John. I've been joined back in our studio by the wonderful John Sheehan and the wonderful Michael Hart. Thanks so much. Listen, you were chatting to earlier. You're going to read. You're here ahead of Tradfest, which is happening next week, obviously, Wednesday. You're sold out, the pair of you.
We are.
You just are amazing, John Sheehan. You told me before we went on air you're going to be 80 on May the 19th.
That's right.
You're the only surviving Dubliner.
The last man.
You look 20 years younger.
Thanks, Miriam.
Everyone listening wants to know, what's your secret?
There's no secret. I just go with the flow, whatever life...
I love it. Health advice.
Whatever life throws to me, I go with it.
Yeah,
I'm a kind of a backseat driver. I don't complain too much about what's on the road.
Keeps playing the music.
The music keeps you young, I think, as well. And mixing around with a new whole generation of young musicians is great, you know.
And he's writing poetry and still writing lovely tunes. Yeah. And that creative side keeps the brain very active and alive. And I think that's probably the secret of his youthfulness.
Yeah, and Michael, of course, you've played with the Dubliners for years yourself, Michael.
I have indeed,
and you're playing together at Tradfest.
Yeah.
Do you want to read? You said to me, John, there's a little poem you wrote for Luke.
Yeah.
The short poem, the great Luke Kelly.
That's
right. Do you
want
to read it for us? It's your own poetry because you're a great poet yourself.
Yeah, the last time I was with you, I think that's about 8 years ago, Barney and myself were here.
McKenna, yeah.
And you know, Barney took a shine to you because we were doing a we were doing a gig in Temple Bar about a week later, and Barney says, I wonder will Miriam be in tonight?
Oh, I loved him.
But
off you go, John.
This is a poem for Luke's, the way he phrased and delivered the song. The long note. You are the one for the phrasing, Luke. I loved the way you played hide and seek with the pulse of a song, stretching a note beyond the bar line till you left us dangling at a cliff edge. With the thread about to snap, you rescued the rhythm and reeled us in to catch a missing heartbeat.
Oh, that's lovely.
That nice?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Listen, you're both going to play for us now. What are you going to play for? Are you going to play Spanish Point?
Yeah, this is a tune I wrote a number of years ago. I have strong family connections with County Clare. My mother was from Menace, and her father, my grandfather, owned a pub there. So we used to spend a lot of holiday time on the west coast of Clare, around Kilkee, Lahinch, Spanish Point, and those areas. So I wrote this piece to try and evoke that time and place.
Well, you get back into your positions, both of you, for playing this. Now, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Mary. Am I going to play the tin whistle on this one? This is my first
instrument. Fantastic. Off you go.
Okay.
I just want to thank today our BCO, Denise Davies, on sound, Julian Avril, my producer, Shannon Gorman. Thanks so much for everything today. Take it away, John and Michael, ahead of Tradfest.
Thanks.
Tradfest.ie.